Looking to get the most out of your money, time, and even better, your points and miles? I'm Chris Hutchins. I'm a lifelong optimizer, and I've sold 2 companies, racked up millions of points, and traveled the world to over 60 countries almost always for free. And I host All the Hacks, an award-winning podcast trusted by more than 1 million listeners that turns big ideas into quick tactical moves you can start using today to upgrade your life, money, and travel. Recent episodes have covered how to book business class seats for economy prices, how to make an easy $3,000 a month from online deals, and tiny habits that you can use to buy back hours of your time each week. There's no fluff in the show. It's just proven playbooks to travel better, spend smarter, and design a life you're excited about. So search All the Hacks. That's All the Hacks in your podcast app. Hit follow and start upgrading your life today.
Looking to buy your dream home or rent that perfect apartment? With the Redfin app, you'll know the moment your next place hits the market. Set up your gotta-have-it wish list, and Redfin will send you real-time notifications for properties that match. And when you're ready to see it in person, scheduling a tour is just a tap away. Thinking about selling? Redfin can do that too. In fact, Redfin agents close twice as many deals as other agents, so they know how to get the best price for your home. And with a listing fee as low as 1%, Redfin charges half of what others often charge. So you could save big, like really big. Last year, Redfin saved home sellers $118 million. So whether you're buying, renting, or selling, Redfin's ready to help you win. Download the Redfin app and start searching today.
The movie begins with someone physically writing down a Bible verse when they could just highlight it in the Bible they stole from the hotel.
Welcome to Wreckatopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from three people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson, Jeremy Scott, and Aaron Dicer.
Will you deliver Spain from bondage?
I don't know. I'm trying. I don't know how.
You do. You will.
Hello, everybody. It is episode 168 of Wreckatopia. My name is Chris Atkinson, joined by Aaron Dicer.
Heidely ho, Aaron Oscarinos.
And we are also joined by Jeremy Scott.
Yes, that is me.
Mm-hmm. Correct. And today's big recommend is The Fountain, and I haven't talked to Jeremy or Aaron about this movie since I mentioned it. I can't wait to hear what they have to say about The Fountain. We are also joined by Chat. Thank you, Chat, for coming out here and watching us talk about movies on a Tuesday. Let's start off with some small recommends.
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty living space.
It's so small and light.
It's small, it's tiny, it's petite, it's wee.
And I watched a movie on Prime Video the other day called Deep Cover. Not to be confused with the Lawrence Fishburne Deep Cover that came out 30 or so years ago. It stars Bryce Dallas Howard, Orlando Bloom, Nick Mohammed as improv actors who were recruited by Sean Bean to infiltrate at first what is like counterfeit cigarettes, which I don't know anything about. I don't know how to counterfeit. I guess you put the slap the label on from Marlboro or something. I don't know. They are told to use their improv skills because undercover cops just can't get the job done for some reason, and use their improv skills to infiltrate this. Of course, they improv way too well, and they get thrown into a big, huge drug ring after all of this. One of the characters in that drug ring is played by Patty Considine. And you also have a great performance from Sonoya Mizuno, who you may remember from Ex Machina as one of the other robots that was in that movie. All three of these actors have different stories, basically. Bryce Dallas Howard is playing someone who used to have huge dreams, kind of like Henry Winkler and Barry almost. She's she's wanted to be huge at one time, but now she just teaches improv acting in London or something like that. Orlando Bloom, who probably steals this movie, is the method actor who goes way, way too far with everything that he does, including an improv. And then Nick Mohammed plays a guy who has no experience whatsoever as an improv actor, but tries and tries and tries, and watching him grow throughout the movie is good. Now, this movie is not great, but I can tell you right now, you will have a very good time with this movie, especially with Orlando Bloom going way, way too far with his method acting and everything. I think that's a hilarious aspect of this movie. You will get some sort of Galaxy Quest, Bugs Life, Three Amigos vibes in this, except in this case, people know, I mean, I guess it's close to that. It's not exactly like those movies, but it's kind of like that, because these people are being mistaken for actual hardened criminals after a while. So anyway, recommend that movie, and have some fun with that.
I agree with everything you said. It's not going to change anybody's life, but you're going to have a good time watching it for sure. And there are just so many fun little running gags in the movie too. One of my favorites is Nick Mohammed, who I've loved in Ted Lasso, which is where I was introduced to him.
Yep.
Is trying to figure out what yes anding actually is, and just several times through the movie, just completely misunderstanding how to yes and. but he's so proud of himself.
Yep.
It's one of my favorites. Everybody's so good. Bryce Dallas Howard is so good. She kind of holds the center really, really well in this movie. And there's this pair of cops that have this like Abbott and Costello vibe to them that are really fun. Like, there's just a lot of fun in this movie for something that should be pretty disposable, but it's fun.
And perhaps in the latest of have the writers of this movie seen CinemaSins, one of those cops says, I think you need to take a look at this, like at the camera. And then the guy's like, why? What are you doing? He's like, I've always wanted to say that. I always thought that was fun. You know, something like that. So
that's awesome. It's good stuff.
Yeah. All right. Who else has got a small recommend?
I'll go next because mine is a video game, and I'm guessing Aaron's is a movie, and so we can bookend. In 1999, I played the hell out of a video game called Commandos Behind Enemy Lines. And it had a few sequels, and I just loved it. I'll tell you all about it here in a second. But in April of this year, 2025, they came out with a revival. Basically, it's a prequel of these games, and it's got huge maps and incredible graphics, and it's basically a modern version, and it's called Commandos Origins. Basically, this is a strategy tactical game, top-down, and it's kind of, if you imagine the Dirty Dozen, right? If you've seen the Dirty Dozen, here in the Commandos, you've got a sniper, and you have a marine, and you have a spy, and they all have special skills. The spy can put on clothes and blend in and walk around freely among the Nazi camp. And basically, you have to infiltrate these various compounds and bases and missile silos and what have you. Every level is different, and you have to choose how to assign each of your people and where to have them go, and there's various hiding places, and the bad guys all have... they're facing a certain direction, but they can't see behind them. Some of them move around. Some of them have flashlights. And you just basically have to strategery your way through each map. And I find it very fulfilling because there's no one right or wrong way to go through a map. And it just lets me be very, very creative. And I have been playing this for about 2 or 3 hours every night for the last 3 weeks. I just love it. If you ever played the originals, you're going to love this game. But if anything I'm saying sounds intriguing, go watch a trailer for this game and see if it's not something that you might be interested in. It is a PC game. I'm playing through Steam, and it's called Commandos Origins, and I love it, love it, love it.
It does sound intriguing. This is a question in the chat. Is it an RTS game?
Real-time strategy. No, I mean, yes, in the sense that everything is happening in real time. So if I want my guy to crawl prone from behind the building to around in front of the building, the bad guys are all still moving, doing their various things. But I don't know if it would qualify technically from like as a literal RTS game.
Qualified
to know.
Well, that sounds very intriguing. One day I'll have time to play video games.
Yeah, that's how I feel too. Because I'm spending all my time watching movies and TV occasionally as well. But I did see Predator Killer of Killers on Hulu. And this is a huge small recommend. I loved this. I think what Dan Trachtenberg is doing with the Predatorverse should be studied in film school. I just think he is reviving it in a really interesting way. He obviously understands, in my opinion, what makes that universe interesting, and has a really good take on it. I will briefly explain what's going on here. This is an animated movie, and it is not, I don't think it's required viewing leading up to Predator Badlands in November, but it's certainly kind of a piece of the puzzle, you know, something you might enjoy knowing with the world building, those kind of things. But the Predators have collected over three different time periods people who bested them. So the first part of the movie is these three stories. And so you see each of these stories as kind of little short films leading up to the finale of these three people having the Predators bring them into their arena and then what happens there. And it's just, it's exciting, it's interesting, it's well performed. I don't think any of the people are necessarily like names you're going to know from like big name actors, but they're clearly talented voiceover performers. They do great character work here. There's a character named Ursa that's kind of a Norse woman, battle maiden kind of thing. And she is incredible. The performance is great. The action in this is so cool. And so, man, there's a lot to love about it. And it doesn't, it also doesn't lose its heart. That's another thing Trachtenberg really understands is there's an undergirding of purpose in these people's lives that keeps it all grounded in a way that really appeals to me. That's one of my big things. So, I'm really excited for Predator Badlands. Predator Killer of Killers is a great step along the way, in my opinion.
Well,
so,
I'm
that's on Hulu.
Hyped for this. I've decided I like Prey more than any Predator movie, even the original. This, just what I've seen of this gives me vibes of other animated action stuff that I've seen that I've really, really liked, like Blue-Eyed Samurai or the Animatrix stuff, kind of.
Right, yeah.
And so I'm really pumped. And yeah, it's fascinating to see a guy who was already a solid filmmaker step into a well-worn franchise and just absolutely breathe new life into it. Like, Predator franchise was dead. Like, and now it's... it's almost one of the hottest things going. I can't wait to see this and see Badlands. Where is this streaming?
Hulu. Oh. This is on Hulu, and Trachtenberg directed both. He directed this and he's directing Badlands. So
I think he had a co-director on the animated.
He did. He did have a co-director on this as well. Awesome. Yes.
All right.
Yep.
Definitely going to see this at some point for sure. All right. Let's go on to our big recommend, which is The Fountain. And it is my recommend. So I'm going to take it away.
I'm fine. I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
The Fountain is a 2006 film written by Darren Aronofsky and Ari Handel and directed by Aronofsky. The movie begins with someone physically writing down a Bible verse when they could just highlight it in the Bible they stole from the hotel. This one concerns Adam and Eve being banished from the Garden of Eden for eating from the tree of knowledge that he explicitly told them not to for reasons that Adam and Eve forgot to write down. We now see a conquistador played by Hugh Jackman bowing before a queen played by Rachel Weisz. She gives him a ring and ensures its safety by closing his hand around it. He tells her, "Let us finish it, but we don't even know what's even begun, and we are taken to the title screen." and the Conquistador and two others approach a very dark place that is hard to see, that is akin to Season 8, Episode 3 of Game of Thrones, which they are convinced is a trap, and soon they are proven right. As they advance, a hidden Mayan army emerges, and the two men with Hugh Jackman try to retreat and climb up a wall, but are struck dead with arrows, leaving our hero to fend off the Mayans by himself. Driven by what he believes is his mission for the Queen's salvation, he charges into the Horde, but is eventually overcome and taken by the army, who drop him off at some stairs and apparently beckon him to climb them. At the top of the stairs, we find a large castle or temple where a final Mayan boss awaits. The Conquistador is challenged by this man, who brandishes a flaming sword, telling him that the First Father sacrificed himself for the Tree of Life, and challenges the hero to join the First Father's fate. Our hero pulls out a dagger. When they approach, the hero is stabbed by the warrior's hidden dagger and is about to bleed out. The warrior tells him death is the road to awe. Cut to the distant future in a yellow nebula where Hugh Jackman is now floating in space and sporting a bald head. He floats over to a snow globe containing a giant tree. He tells the tree that he won't let it die. When he attempts to touch the tree, the hairs on it stand on end. He peels bark off the tree and eats it. A voice, probably from Field of Dreams, tells him to finish it. Cut to the modern day, where Rachel Weisz tells Hugh Jackman to come take a walk with him, and he says, I have too much work. And to me, when Rachel Weisz tells you to come take a walk with her, there's no such thing as work. But apparently in Hugh Jackman's world, he does. We find out that their names are Tommy and Izzy, and their names probably have nothing to do with a Michigan State basketball coach. During this argument, it cuts back to the future as if this argument still haunts Tommy, or it's rattling around in another futuristic world known as his head. His response from the past echoes in the future. Sorry, I'll see you tonight, he says, and then he floats off and imitates the opening credits of every James Bond film and does yoga or something in silhouette. Future Tommy tattoos his arm while he sees a vision of Izzy in her bed. He goes to wash his arm off and is once again told to finish it. With a quick flash of Izzy running through a room, he seems resigned to do whatever the voice of Izzy wants him to do. He trusts her and is willing to be taken. But then we are once again greeted with Izzy wanting Tommy to take a walk as future and present blend together again. Izzy, disappointed, walks off without Tommy. Realizing what a mistake this is, he chases after Izzy but is stopped by Manny, played by Ethan Suplee, who tells him that their lab monkey Donovan is open and ready for surgery. Apparently, Tommy is at work at his lab, which is lit and designed like a haunted house. Was Izzy even here? Is this a conversation that haunts him even in the present? Are the past, present, and future some amalgamation of the same thing? We see an ethereal Izzy walking out the door, but Manny doesn't seem to even acknowledge it. Tommy scrubs down and he removes his ring, which the movie brings attention to a lot, probably because it represents the promise to his wife and the circular passing of time and the circle of life and whatnot. Someone named Antonio, played by Sean Patrick Thomas, tells him whatever they used on Donovan isn't the answer Tommy is looking for. They'll have to euthanize this patient because the growth inside him will kill him anyway if they don't treat him. While Tommy retreats to the scrubbing area, a literal light bulb above his head gives him an idea. Why don't they try this one compound they derive from a tree in Guatemala and mix it with this other compound that they just used on the patient? Whoa, is this tree in Guatemala the literal tree of life? Tommy asks Antonio to envision the two compounds together in the throes of hot, sweaty cowgirl sex so that everyone can understand. This last-second treatment probably isn't ethical, but audiences were used to Dr. House episodes in 2006, and ethics are for losers. After the surgery, Tommy realizes he's lost his ring. While he searches for it, Tommy's boss, played by Ellen Burstyn, comes in to talk to him. She's not happy with the sloppy surgeries because a fully functioning NIH that wasn't cut by Doge in 2006 could shut them down. She tells him to spend more time with Izzy, but ironically, he's at work for her, even though he's wasting precious time he could be having with her trying to find a cure for her cancer. Back at home, on a ledge outside a window, Izzy wants Tom to look through a telescope to see a golden nebula wrapped around a dying star that looks a lot like the place in space we saw earlier. She tells him that the Mayans believe this to be their underworld, where dead souls go to be reborn. She's also apparently writing a book about it. Also, she appears to have been out in the cold without wearing any shoes, but can't even feel it. He gives her a bath, and when he applies a sponge of steaming hot water on her, he realizes that she can't physically feel hot and cold, which she admits has been happening for some time. Doesn't matter. They have attractive people tub sex and splash water everywhere on the floor. Izzy gives Tommy her book to read, which is called The Fountain. It's the book of the movie we're watching, and to sell that point hard, Tommy says, but it's not done, indicating that the book's ending largely depends on how he chooses, kind of like the never-ending story. When the phone rings, she tells him not to answer it, but he does, meaning he still hasn't quite figured out what's important in life. He rushes to the lab to find out that Donovan seems to be doing great. His surgery scar is healing and he's become smarter, practically stopping the effects of aging. However, the size of the tumor hasn't changed. And while the cocktail they used seemed to have some tremendous effect that science should pursue, Tommy is still focused on curing cancer and is already ordering the next patient to go to surgery in the production of a new cocktail. When Tommy gets back home, he starts reading his wife's book, which takes him into the middle of a Paul Bettany scene from The Da Vinci Code. It's set during the time of the Spanish Inquisition. The Grand Inquisitor, played by Stephen McCaddy, has just acquired new lands from the Queen, who is going to suffer for her sins. The conquistador we saw earlier, named Tomas, begins a quest that has been strictly forbidden by her. He decides he's going to kill the Inquisitor, who is currently hanging heretics by their feet in some sort of horrible torture tactic. Tomas is about to assassinate him when Captain Ariel, played by Cliff Curtis, shows up. He tells Tommy to return to the Queen and forget about all of this, which he does, leaving a bunch of hanging heretics to die. When he goes to talk to the Queen, she makes him realize that killing the Inquisitor would not help her or Spain out, because she would be blamed and killed anyway. She isn't ready to die, but she has a plan. She calls upon Father Avila, played by Mark Margolis, who apparently found something so powerful in New Spain that it would free all mankind from tyranny. The Queen's insistence on finding it raised the ire of the Inquisitor, who waged war on Spain to stop her. Father Avila gives Tommy the dagger we saw earlier in the movie, one that also functions as a map to a hidden pyramid containing a tree that contains a sap that whosoever drinks from it will have everlasting life. The Queen believes this is confirmed by the Bible, that Adam and Eve ate from the tree of knowledge and the tree of life was hidden from them. But it's okay if modern-day tree of life enthusiast wants to eat from it. God has mellowed since the Adam and Eve days. Anyway, the biblical record proves that whatever Father Avila found must be true. We are then taken to a more contextual look at what the beginning of the movie showed us. Not only is he going on a quest to save the Queen's life, he's also going to get to marry the Queen if he returns with a sample of the tree of life. After he reads this, Tommy finds himself alone in his office with Izzy gone. Izzy is at some museum where she has found a Mayan book talking about the first human who sacrificed himself for the world, and the tree of life grows from his body, which in turn became the entire earth and its skies, creating the nebula that the Mayans consider their underworld. She seems to be mulling over the act of death as creation and asks Tommy about it, who doesn't answer and runs to go get the car. She then collapses and has a seizure. Tommy remains steadfast in his belief that he's found a cure and that she needs to hold on. Izzy insists that she's ready to die and has begun to see death as a good thing. Tommy goes back to the lab, where the doctors are all happy with the incredible miracle drug they've given Donovan, but nonetheless still doesn't cure cancer. While his boss wants to talk to him, Tommy orders a new surgery. After that, his boss once again scolds him for not looking at the big picture, and he admits that he's driven only by finding a cure before his wife dies. She's shocked to find out that his wife is in the hospital and he's not there for her. She reminds him that discovering a drug overnight that's going to save her isn't possible. Tommy does eventually go back to the hospital, where he once again wants to mention a breakthrough. She interrupts, telling him he's her conquistador. This miracle cure doesn't matter to her. She wants to give him a gift. It's a pen and ink to finish her story. Don't pay attention to the fact that this is a fountain pen. That's probably meaningless. Anyway, she wants his help in finishing it, echoing the finish it we heard from earlier. It's here that Izzy tells Tommy the basis for the dialogue during the fight at the beginning of the movie. A Mayan friend of hers talked about a seed being planted in his father's grave where his body became a tree. Sparrows ate the fruit from the tree, and now his father flies with the birds. Death was his father's road to awe. Future Danny assures the Izzy tree that when the nebula explodes, she will be reborn. He eats another piece of bark from the tree. Tommy goes back to Izzy's book, reading a chapter focusing on Father Avila's discovery of the hidden place using the dagger, a place that is marked by conspicuous circles in the ground. Cut to Captain Ariel back at a camp where he tells the other men he's leading us in circles, not knowing how prophetic that is. Ariel and the other conquistadors are lamenting the fact that this quest is preventing them from protecting the queen by force. They want to stop Tommy from going further, conspiring to kill him. But when Tommy enters the tent, they try to get him to turn back instead. But Tommy is unfazed. When Father Avila comes back to tell what he found, Ariel kills him, and Tommy kills Ariel along with all the other conspirators except for two, who he gives the chance to live if they stay with him. Avila gives him the dagger before he dies, pointing to the direction of the temple. Apparently the reading made Tommy go to sleep, as the next thing we see him is him being awakened by beeping on Izzy's monitor. He's ushered outside the room, where his boss finds him and tells him that Donovan's tumor is at long last shrinking. It's too late to save Izzy, though. The doctors in Izzy's room are officially declaring her dead by pulling the sheets over her head. Tommy tries to do CPR, the doctors attempt to kick him out, and he nearly murders a dude for telling him to get out. Tommy's futile CPR leads the movie to cut to future Tommy, who finds the Izzy tree starting to die. We now cut to a funeral at the farm where Izzy wanted to be buried. It's here where Hugh Jackman asks Christian Bale, "What knot did you tie?" And Bale says, "I don't know." And then Jackman yells, "You don't know?" Anyway, Tommy walks away from the funeral, still obsessed with finding the cure. But this time, he's talking about death as a disease that can be cured. Tommy looks at an empty chapter 12 coming right after the fight with the Mayan at the Tree of Life. He then takes the fountain pen and pokes a hole in his ring finger. He dips the pen in ink and then his own blood. He pokes another spot, and then we see future Tommy with an inky ring around his finger, along with a lot of inky rings around his arm that may or may not represent the rings of a tree. He talks to Izzy, telling her that the rings represent his memories and how she's pulled him through time. Tommy returns to his lab, and he assures his team that he's okay, and he's on board with trying to build on what they've created. Back at the Nebula, an inconsolable Tommy is confronted by his wife and asks what she wants. She turns into the Queen of Spain, and she asks, "Will you deliver Spain from bondage?" He repeats the line from earlier when Izzy asked him to finish the book, saying he doesn't know how, and she returns with the same dialogue, "You do, you will." He says he's going to die, and she says, "Together we will live forever." He goes back to the tree and assures him that they will live forever, but he again hears the "finish it." It now cuts back to Izzy asking Tommy to go for a walk, and he's once again stopped by one of his doctors, and he watches Izzy walk out. But this time, he runs out the door after Izzy. Cut back to the Nebula, and Tommy climbs the Izzy tree and floats into space, into a heavenly void. Now we cut back to the fight with the Mayan who stabbed him, who reminds him that death is the road to awe. Future Tommy appears in front of the Mayan, who calls him the First Father, and he offers himself up for sacrifice. Now that he seems to have learned that death is not the end, he walks through the passage and finds the Tree of Life. He drives a dagger through it, and milky sap comes out of it, and when it drips on the ground, another plant springs forth. And much like what happens in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Tommy uses the magic elixir to fix his stab wound. He then stabs the tree again and greedily drinks from the tree, only to seemingly be pulled into a higher dimension, where he tries to put on the ring that will officially wed him to the queen. But a metamorphosis happens, where a tree begins to grow from his body. He's dying, but isn't he also living? Future Nebula Tommy puts on the ring, and then he really is taken into another dimension. And it brings us all the way back to the gravesite, where Tommy plants a seed where she's buried. The nebula in the sky appears to grow brighter, perhaps at once finally dying, but giving birth to new stars, a new life. He tells Izzy that he's finished it. She asks, "Is everything all right?" And he responds, "Yes, everything's all right." And that's how the movie ends. Guys, what did you think of The Fountain?
Am I the only one that heard that sly little Prestige reference?
Either that or it's not nearly as funny as I thought it was when I wrote it down.
I didn't see any response in the chat, and I couldn't read Aaron's face to see. I sat here giggling for 30 seconds.
I missed it. What was it?
Something about at the funeral, yeah, he says, "You don't know? You don't know?
You don't know what tied? You don't know what knot you tied?" Yeah. I did do it very stream of consciousness, so if you didn't catch it.
No, that's
it,
best. Keep it subtle. Yeah. No, that's good.
Aaron, you want to go or me?
Sure, I'll go. I love this movie. I loved it the first time I saw it. Was very excited to see it again. I think I watched it, I think I had it from Netflix back when they were sending DVDs. Mm. Does that make sense time-wise? Mm. That feels like in my mind what happened is I had the DVD from Netflix and I watched it like, you know, three times before I sent it back.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is because I am a sucker for movies that let you do the work, right? And like that let you look at the metaphors, look at the symbology, you know, all that stuff, and to think deep thoughts about the things that they're saying. And there are some really deep thoughts you can think in a movie that's clearly grappling with death. That's what this movie is doing. It's grappling with the idea of death, what it means. Is it an end? Is it a beginning? Is it good? Is it bad? Is it painful? Is it joyful? Like all of those things are here. And I just love exploring that intellectually. Then there's also great performances. There is a literal story involved of this man and his wife in the modern times. I think we're pretty clearly supposed to believe the conquistador stuff is her first chapters. And then I think it's more ambiguous, at least as I'm reading it, that the future stuff are his chapters, or maybe it's real. Maybe he figured out the secret to life and lived forever and went to visit this tree in this nebula. I think the movie lets you go down both those roads equally. I choose to prefer the idea that these are his chapters and that he is finishing the book.
That's my interpretation of it as well.
That's how I choose to look at it. I love little touches. One that I caught this time that I'd never caught before was the idea of using the gift that she gave him to finish the story, to create something permanent as a refusal to finish the story. Like there's this really interesting thing that he uses that fountain pen, as you mentioned, to create a wedding ring tattoo instead of finish the story she asked him to finish, at least right away. And I think we're supposed to get the idea that he eventually does finish the story and that that's how he processes death and finds the awe involved with the end of the story. But at least initially his response is, no, I'm going to extend this as far as possible. And even in the you know, Hugh Jackman we see in the future, he's extended it even more with these you know, tattoos that represent time. And as you mentioned, our rings on a tree, you know, the idea of years passing, and just the movie is just so full and beautiful with that kind of imagery. And I love it. I was reading some trivia and I'm just so glad we got the Hugh Jackman, Rachel Weisz stripped down version of this movie, as opposed to what I understand was supposed to be Brad Pitt and Kate Blanchett in a big budget version of this movie. And don't get me wrong, I don't mind big budget thinky movies. Nolan does them all the time, and I tend to really like that stuff. But I'm just really glad this movie specifically feels so stripped down. And I also feel like Hugh Jackman's performance here is perfect for this movie. And I just... And maybe it's just a sense of that's the one I've seen, but I just can't imagine what Brad Pitt would have done in this role that would have been as good. So I'm glad we got this version. I love the idea of combining a Fountain of Youth with the Tree of Life. That's a really interesting combination that the movie is doing that I really, really enjoy. And then I just wanted to read this quote that to me kind of sums up the whole movie when she's talking about the story. She says, he said that if they dug his father's body up, it would be gone. They planted a seed over his grave.
I was going to read this exact thing. Go ahead.
Because it's so good. The seed became a tree. Moses said his father became part of that tree. He grew into the wood, into the bloom. And when a sparrow ate the tree's fruit, his father flew with the birds. He said death was his father's road to awe. That's what he called it, the road to awe. Now, I've been trying to write the last chapter, and I haven't been able to get that out of my head. And so the fact now that Hugh Jackman's character is wrestling with, how do I put that as the last chapter of this book? How do I explain death as not this brutal finish, but this beautiful transition I just think it's really beautiful. And as somebody who has my own perspective on what the afterlife might be, and as somebody who, by the way, died for a couple days, like that added some perspective to my whole thing, because I came out of that and it wasn't like I was asleep. It was different. When I came out of my coma after my heart had stopped, it was a different waking, and that time, I don't have stories of going towards the light or any of that. I just didn't exist for a couple days. And I was okay with that. There was a peace to that understanding, you know, that whether I'm right or wrong, whether you're right or wrong about what you believe happens when you die or whatever, is kind of not the point, because it will be what it is. And I think there's a peace in accepting that, that, you know, we have this for the time we have it, and then we have, you know, something else that may be a contribution to the universe in a way that we're not even, you know, thinking about. And I just love thinking all those thoughts through this movie.
Did you see where Jeremy Renner was given an interview a week or so ago and said that when he came out of his coma after his accident, he was mad. Like, he didn't want to come back. And I didn't read in full. I only skimmed the first few paragraphs. And maybe he expounded on that more. Maybe he did see light or something. But I got the sense that it was more just a peacefulness. I think there is something, I think there is something to living as a human that is just oppressive and hard. And knowing that weight is lifting, I think, can bring peace in the moment of death. And I think that section you read, I'm sorry if I'm interrupting if you have more thoughts, but we'll get back to you in a second.
No, that's it. You're good. Yeah, go.
But that,
your
that
stuff.
Story she tells about the death and the planting of the seed and the soul becoming part of the bloom and then the flying away with the bird, I think is the movie's main point. Like, the only thing I disagree with what you said, Aaron, is that I don't think it has any questions about death. I think it firmly believes death is a new beginning and a positive transition.
Yes, and, I agree. I think that's what it's saying.
I don't think I ever saw this movie in full now that I've seen it for this show. And I really, really, really liked it. I need to watch it more before I can say I loved it, because it is such a heady movie. But that's one of the things I like most about it, is that my first note is, what a fucking swing. Like, I love when somebody makes a movie like this where they know exactly what they want to do, and it's like nothing I've ever seen before. I like Aronofsky more often than not, but what he does, his wheelhouse is obsession, right? Mm-hmm. Like The Wrestler and The Black Swan, and this movie, all the main characters have an unhealthy obsession, which is one of the reasons I'm always going to be disappointed we never got Aronofsky's Batman movie, because he was going to do Year One, and that would have really been interesting. So yeah, he's really... I had to look it up. I didn't realize this. This is right after Requiem for a Dream. I had thought this had come later in his career. So, again, Requiem for a Dream was a big critical darling, and whoever financed The Fountain was just like, I'm just going to let you do whatever you want, because you're weird and people like it. And it's rare to see a movie that sits in my head and my heart for as long as this one does, that's only 90 minutes long. Like, this is not a long movie, and yet it says every bit as much as some other 3-hour movies have to say. I really liked all of the parallels, the things that happen in more than one time period, and then, like, each time period having its own visual flair and language of images and shapes. And it's not like anything I've ever seen before. I struggled mightily on the super secret double feature. But yeah, I do think the performances make it. And what's weird is Rachel Weisz was dating Aronofsky when they made this movie, and he didn't want to cast her. But Hugh Jackman basically just begged for him to cast her, and I'm really glad he did, because Hugh Jackman has the showier role from an acting perspective here. But she is much more of an anchor, I think, that he is able to play against, and you don't really get his performance if she's not giving her performance. I thought that the beginning was... I think you guys are right, having heard what you said. I think the beginning are her chapters and the end is his chapters. But while I'm watching it, I thought the beginning was the story that she based her first chapters on, the story she tells him about the conquistador or what have you. I thought it was like a historical presentation of that story that had been passed down. But yeah, I have no conclusions. I have to watch it again. I really, really liked it.
Yeah, this is one of these movies that you recommend and you know that a lot of people are not going to like it when they watch it, especially if it's the first time. And like I said, the first time I watched this movie, I was so lost about what was going on that just could not enjoy it and everything. And then it took me years to revisit it. And it was on that second viewing that I realized how much I really liked this movie. And then now watching it yet again, I am in love with this movie. There's an interesting tidbit too about how Warner Brothers didn't want Darren Aronofsky to do a commentary for the Blu-ray. I have the Blu-ray, so that was a little bit disappointing, but he made a commentary to go on his website. I ended up watching it. Somebody's put it on YouTube with the movie. So I watched the commentary with the movie. And one of the things he was talking about as far as the visuals were concerned, you're talking about this, Jeremy, was, you know, he started off very intentionally making everything in the darkness at the very beginning. It's very super dark. You don't even know what the hell's going on. And that's on purpose. Then he very intentionally made the ending of the movie light, very much light and everything. And he started pointing out, Darren Aronofsky obviously doesn't go into full detail about what the movie means and all that. He's really more talking about his experience on the movie, who he worked with. We're talking about the soundtrack here by Clint Mansell, who once again is killing it on one of these. He kills it on the other two movies before this too, Pi and Requiem for a Dream. But he also talks about how there's a part where he's walking through his house and there's all these light bulbs hanging down. And it's like, he's sort of in a constellation here, even in his own house. Didn't really think about it that way until he brought that up, and everything. And I was like, yeah, that's somebody who's really on top of what story he's telling and knows at all times what's going on here. And I very much appreciate that. All the way through. I mean, sometimes it feels like the symbolism is obvious, and then some other times it makes you go, "What? Whoa! What did he mean by that?" You know. And so, like, I love the mixture, because there's so many different ways you can interpret so many different things. Again, what you said, Jeremy, 90-minute movie. You know, it feels like a 3-hour epic, but it's only 90 minutes, and you know, I don't know where this ranks as far as Darren Aronofsky movies are concerned. It's got to be in my top three. Black Swan is up there for sure. And I love Requiem for a Dream. I know that you, I don't know if you guys do or not, but,
I only have Mother above this.
Mother. Mother is another one that I need to revisit. That's one that I saw in theaters and haven't seen since. So
yeah, that's my number one. This is my number two.
So yep. Yeah, Mother. But yeah, I love the bare bones premise even of this movie, though, where you're talking about, he's so obsessed with trying to find a cure for this cancer that he doesn't even spend time with his wife that he loves. And that just goes for any single, it doesn't have to be a doctor looking for the cure for cancer. It can be any kind of job that you're, or any kind of obsession that you are, you know, you're doing this for your family, but you're not spending any time with your family. And you don't realize that the time that you have with them is precious and everything like that. So
it's very Breaking Bad in that way.
I was just thinking that. Yeah, it's exactly like that. He's like, I'm doing this for my family. And then of course, you know, he had more than enough money to care for his family, and he just kept doing it and kept doing it and kept doing it. So yeah, I very much appreciate all that. I mean, this is just a type of movie that I feel like I'll watch again in a few years, and I'll find even more things that I didn't realize the last time I watched it. So,
yep.
All right. Well, let's get on to our, super, super secret double feature.
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
Aaron, what do you got?
Yeah. So I went through various ideas here. I talked about Nolan. I thought of some Nolan movies that you know, might feel good playing with the different timelines, that kind of stuff. But I eventually went to a movie I recently saw for the first time in the last couple of years, a 1979 film called Stalker. Which to me feels tonally almost identical to this movie.
Yep.
It involves taking two people on a journey. One's a writer, one's a professor. And I kind of feel like those are the archetypes we're dealing with in this movie as well, the writer and the professor. And it is a fantastical journey. It's symbology and metaphor. There's a lot of things you're not sure if they're literal or if they are fantastical, if they are personal interpretations, if they're dreamscapes. That kind of thing. But overall, it's hard to describe the plot of this movie. Let's just say it's a journey into a protected space that has these supposed fantastical things that can happen, including granting you your greatest wish, is supposedly what's being protected here. And it deals with some of those same themes of what is the obsession worth? What is the value? Is it the journey? Is it the destination? All that stuff is here. So I recently saw this. It kind of blew me away. And while I was thinking about double features, it came to mind. And I was like, oh, yeah, tonally, that really feels very similar to me. So
Stalker is phenomenal. It was a movie I saw not too long ago myself for the first time. And this is a great super secret double feature for sure.
Well, I'm going a little weird today, folks. If I was going to go, my first instinct, which I'm not choosing, was Cloud Atlas, because I think it has a lot of similar themes, and we're jumping around in different times, and we have actors playing more than one character. But man, I'm not going to make anybody sit through Cloud Atlas. And I also think jumping around through time and really heavy themes, it's just too much for a double feature. So instead of tone, I decided to go with topic. And to me, The Fountain is really about, like you said, Aaron, death and wrestling with death. And I think ultimately accepting death. And so I'm going to choose a movie that I think once you watch the two of them would offer a completely different viewing experience, but another perspective of someone accepting death, and that's Jacob's Ladder, which is weird because tonally I don't think it's similar at all, but
no,
in terms of topic and maybe some themes, Jacob's Ladder is about a soldier who comes back from war and starts having really weird visions and runs into some of his old platoon members, and they're having weird visions too. And I won't say any more, but it's the journey that he goes on to discover what's causing those visions. I just think that would be a nice conversation starter.
And then is told by the government and is shunned by his friends who were with him that he even had those visions. It's such a good movie.
Yeah, and also I see somebody said The Green Knight. I very nearly picked The Green Knight.
Green Knight would be an amazing double feature with us for sure. Talk about a movie that I think that's going to increase the more I watch it. I haven't seen it since it first came out, but
I love it.
I'm still like in that I don't know category, but I think eventually I'm just going to accept it for what it is and just love it.
If we did a double feature of The Fountain and The Green Knight, we'd have to hand out drugs beforehand.
Probably so.
Why don't we anyway? I thought you were going to say 50-50 for your double feature.
or Nymphomaniac. So, we're going to go to our next assignment. What is our next homework assignment? It's Jeremy's turn. And what does Jeremy say we have to watch next week?
I promise. I swear to Holy Moses, I did not intentionally set us up to do back-to-back Hugh Jackman.
Well, I will intentionally set us up for back-to-back-to-back, so you can be assured of that. Right.
Well, this is a movie that came out several years ago that I've seen three times that I just don't see anyone ever talk about. It's on HBO Max, and it's called Bad Education. Also stars Allison Janney, and this is based on a true story of corruption at a really well-funded, overly funded prep school, and the hijinks that ensue when some students catch on to what's happening. I really, really like it. I haven't seen it in about 3 or 4 years, so I'm excited to get back into it. And it's, again, on HBO Max.
Well, I love this movie, so I'll be looking forward to revisiting it as well.
It's a great choice.
Yeah, this is one of those that, like, I guess I won't say too much about it, but I do like a certain thing about this movie that I'll just leave there.
I can't wait.
All right. It looks like we have some time for some questions.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I am listening.
Let's go to the old question bag. Let's see. What movie trope slash trend needs to make a comeback? So I have written down smoking, even though I do not condone it. I do not condone smoking, but I feel like we're missing something from movies that people can't smoke anymore. They have to put that in the rating now that they're smoking in a movie. Like, nobody smokes anymore. In fact, there's a movie that I have recently watched where the character goes out for cigarettes, and I'm like, no, he didn't. That character doesn't smoke. You know, whatever. Like, I know that's going out for cigarettes and abandoning the family. It's a cliche or whatever. But the wife would have known immediately that was a ruse. That person doesn't smoke anyway. There's something about smoking in movies. I've never been a smoker. I don't condone smoking. I just think it's cool in movies, and they just decided to make it a thing, you know, a taboo. So anyway, look, there you go.
I feel the same way about murder. You know,
it looks
so cool.
Exactly.
You know? I never do it in real life. But
as somebody who is a former smoker, I started because I wanted to be cool. It's so fucking stupid. These guys that we were hanging out with at a party were smoking, and they were like, "Do you want one?" And I was like, "Okay." And then I. And then the dude mocked me by saying, "You're not even inhaling." And I said to myself, "Well, we better show him." And so I inhaled big and deep and coughed for the next 3 hours. And that is the beginning of my nicotine addiction. I do not recommend or condone smoking. I do agree with Chris that there are moments in movies where it looks cool.
I think it's the cinematic nature of the smoke itself sometimes. The way the light can hit it and the things you can do with it.
Yeah.
You watch some of those old movies and the way it's lit
also
is
also the way
really,
you
really
can punctuate dialogue and statements with a dramatic stage drag and pause.
Yeah.
I wrote down hardcore nudity, but then I wrote, no, just kidding. And my real answer is long opening credits with score that set the mood, like Seven or Signs or most of Hitchcock's movies. I appreciate that, and it's mostly gone. And we're probably to blame in some respect because we rip on credits that go on for too long or opening logos that go on for too long. But man, when I watch... I don't even really love Signs, but when I watch Signs or when I watch Seven, and there's a handful of other movies I'm not thinking of that do the same, Untouchables is the same way, I get in the mood through the opening credits because the music and the whole presentation of the thing just gets me there. So
North by Northwest does that for me. That beginning score, North by Northwest, I'm just like, let's go. Yeah,
well, and then like Stranger Things, like that opening score for it, all of its episodes and everything really get me in, you know, to watch Stranger Things because it's got that 80s gloomy mood to it and everything. So yeah, I totally with you on that.
Yeah. I said walking away from explosions. There was a great that was Lonely Island, right? Or yeah. SNL or whatever. The yeah. cool guys walk away from explosions or whatever. And it kind of put an end to that. And it is actually cool. I did see it pop up in a recent movie, and it was one of my favorite moments of the year. I don't know if you saw Thelma. Thelma's a great movie,
yeah.
but these are older people, and at the end they accidentally explode something, and they have no idea they're walking away from it because they can't hear it, and it made me laugh so funny because it was so cool and so funny.
I regretted not bringing up during our end of the year thing. That was a movie that you had thrown on the hey Chris, you need to watch this thing, and I loved Thelma. I thought that was a great movie.
Yeah, Thelma's great.
Let's see. Over in the chat, let's see. Does anybody have any money? Nobody's really answering that. yeah, Signs in particular gets you psyched and scared perfectly. I like the score in Signs. I don't like the movie. On the next question, what repeated actor-director combo is your favorite? Meaning actors that have worked multiple times with the same director. Which combo is your fave? For me, Denzel Washington and Spike Lee, they pretty much always knock it out of the park when they're together. And then this recent Ryan Coogler, Michael B. Jordan string of movies is phenomenal. So those are my two. Those are great.
Good call.
Yeah. Yeah. And Sinners just locks that in, man.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, it's just like, it's, yeah, it's legendary.
I get to watch Sinners this week. My brother's coming.
And I'm nice. Nice.
Yeah, you said Denzel and my brain immediately went to Denzel and Tony Scott because they've made a bunch of movies together and they're all highly watchable. I think they've made 5 movies together. But the answer I wrote down was McQuarrie and Tom Cruise. It goes beyond Mission Impossible. I really like the first Jack Reacher film that they made together.
Yeah.
And then McQuarrie was heavily involved in Top Gun Maverick. Even though Kaczynski directed it, McQuarrie was a producer and he worked on the script. And there's just a chemistry there that works. I get the sense they're never going to stop working together because they just kind of have a shared insanity and a way of working.
And I think McQuarrie wrote Valkyrie too, as well.
I think you're right.
McQuarrie Singer production. And then I guess that's where it all must have started there. And just think about how Mission Impossible started. He was getting a new director every single time. I think he was trying to find he wasn't trying to find the perfect guy. He was just trying to find a new guy, a new vision every time. And then he gets Christopher McQuarrie and he's like, let's just stick with this guy. This guy knows what I want. So, yeah, love that.
It was always going to be Hitchcock, and it was either going to be Jimmy Stewart or Cary Grant, and I decided to go with Cary Grant. They did 4 movies together, and 3 of them are absolute bangers. To Catch a Thief is fine, but North by Northwest, Notorious, and Suspicion are all incredible films, and they always do so good together. So, yeah, shout out that.
Over in the chat, JC says, I know it's only 2, but Kubrick and Kirk Douglas had 2 back-to-back bangers. I believe that's Paths of Glory and Spartacus. Nolan says, I like Peele and Daniel Kaluuya. Lang says, Sam Jackson and Quentin Tarantino. Yeah, for sure. R1MA78 says, Kurosawa and Takashi Shimura. Of course. And then, let's see, Link says, Johnny Depp and Tim Burton. Yeah, I mean, I don't like every movie they've made, but they're a good partnership for sure. R1MA78 also says, Herzog and Kinski, probably because they hated each other. Those are some epic, epic stories about how much they could not get along, but yet could not stop working with each other for some reason. We also have a vote for Christopher Nolan and Christian Bale. And James says James Gray and Joaquin Phoenix, even though it's been a minute since they worked together. Yeah, they had a string of movies like in the early 2000s, and I don't think they've worked together since. But anyway, those are all some good choices. And that's going to do it for this week. Next week is Bad Education, the Hugh Jackman Bad Education. I think there's a Pedro Almodovar movie called Bad Education. Don't confuse it with that. I think that's right. If I'm wrong,
I know there's a TV show. I know there was a Bad Education.
Yeah, I think there was a Bad Education Pedro Almodovar movie. But anyway, it's the Hugh Jackman Bad Education that came out on HBO or whatever the last time. Anyway, that'll be next week, and that's going to do it for this week. Thank you so much, chat, for coming out. We appreciate it. Just going to do it for this week. We'll see you next time. See ya.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
See you guys.
Bye.
Part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
I went for my first bike ride in a couple weeks since I've been sick. Mm. And it always astounds me, especially as I get older, how quickly my body is like, nope, we don't do that anymore. You know, like I go out on my first bike ride. Now, part of that is also recovery, I think. But there's just an element of just takes a couple weeks and the body forgets everything it knew about how to process oxygen and, you know, how to use the proper muscles. And it's just like, man, getting old, it changes all that
I think it's terrible that when you exercise, you know, you get that high from exercising and it encourages you to keep doing it. But as soon as you don't do it and you fall into the laps of like, you know, I don't want to do this, it never calls back to you. It's not the drug that you hope it is.
They just finished a trail from our local park to a battlefield national park that's nearby. Mm-hmm. And so it's like 3 miles over there and it's like a 3 mile loop through this like battlefield historical, you know, kind of thing. And so I've got a nice, like, you know, 7 mile loop I can do.
Mm-hmm.
And rumor is they're going to connect that trail to the Springfield Trail system. So if I even wanted to go into the Springfield trails and stuff, I could. But that's why I like biking when there's a way to get out on trails and just ride, you know, for several miles.
That's my main, I love riding bikes. I haven't ridden one in forever, but like, I love riding bikes, but like, I don't want to be the person who's out in traffic riding my bike and stuff like that. And I want to find a place that's kind of like secluded and that I can just ride and not worry about and just only worry about running over pedestrians. So,
yes. I find bike lanes on roads to be the silliest thing ever invented. I just like either have a sidewalk that's wide enough for bikes to ride on or, you know, or don't, because it's just like, it's so dangerous.
Yeah, and the other day there was a road that had no bike lanes on it, and he was just kind of like just riding his bike on the road, and cars were behind him, and I'm like, dude, can you not like get over for a second and let at least these cars go by and then get back on the road and then kind of wash, rinse, repeat a little bit so that everybody's not frustrated behind you? But
I gotta tell
some people just don't
care.
I
had a boss who got really into biking on the road, and if he's in any way indicative of people who bike on the road, they hate you and your car.
I just feel like there's a lot of common sense involved, and some people just don't choose to practice common sense in that way. But like for me, there's like one part where the park path crosses a decently busy road. Now, technically, there's a yield sign there, right? Like technically, cars are supposed to let any walkers or bikers or whatever cross. If they're at that cross, they're supposed to stop for them or whatever. But do I just barrel through there thinking I've got right away? No, I pay attention. That's somebody's on their phone and they don't even know I'm there and I would have been dead. You know, it's like,
man, don't even get me started on yield signs, man. Yield signs are the like freaking, what do you call it? What is it Barbosa calls? They're more like guidelines than anything. And like, there's a place that I drive all the time out here that people are coming off of the interstate and you know, there's a yield to ease onto the street
right.
from the interstate. And it doesn't matter how close I am to them as they approach that yield sign. They always feel entitled that they need to be on the road more than I do.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I understand too that there's a get over and let people over type of things. I can't do that all the time. I'm sorry, I can't. And like, these people just come up to the yield sign and just like, well, nobody is immediately to my side, so I just guess I'll get over, even though you're like right there. So yeah, I hate yield signs so much. I hate them. Just put a stop sign there. If you want to really stop people from doing that kind of thing, put a stop sign, put a light, something.
Station a traffic cop. You know, just put put a human being there.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, put a baby crib there.
There. But fill it with cans. It's only cans.
Yeah, fill it cans. Fill it cans, yeah.
Sprite has a new flavor. Sprite with tea. I'm an iced tea guy. Mm-hmm. I like iced tea mixed with lemonade, Arnold Palmer. And Sprite is kind of like carbonated lemonade, right? So I was like, I can see how that might work, right? And then I read, there's no caffeine in it. And I was like, well, how lovely of them to have used decaffeinated tea in this new beverage product so that, like Sprite, I can drink it whenever I want and not worry about added caffeine. So I buy a bottle, I chill it in the fridge, I take it out. Doesn't taste like tea. It tastes like, I told my wife, the best I can describe it is, it's modified Sprite. So I immediately went to the ingredients. There's no fucking tea in this drink. There's no tea in Sprite plus tea. They just added stuff that they think might equal tea flavor.
Sprite without tea is just Sprite.
Or Sprite.
I wish people listening could hear my eyes roll. Mm-hmm.
They can. Mm-hmm. They can. Mm-hmm.
I feel like 5% of Jeremy's life is going to the grocery store and looking for that new flavor, that new mm-hmm. drink.
You are not even wrong. Mm-hmm. I will not deny it. I go every day, basically, because the Starbucks I visit is inside the grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm usually, as I walk to the exit, I glance, I walk by a couple of cases where they keep bottled drinks so I can see if there's anything new.
Why not?
My wife's the same way with Doritos flavors.
Yeah. I've started buying more flavors because I start getting tired of the ones that I'm drinking all the time. So I do kind of do that every once in a while, but I have to make sure mine is like the zero sugar variety and stuff like that. And they've made tremendous strides on those, by the way. Almost everything that you like sugar wise has got a zero or a diet, but sometimes you just can't find some of those things. Sometimes it's just like, oh, new flavor, but it's all the sugar. So